This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today we are going to start talking about our immune systems. This is the thing that we rely on to keep us well, to keep us healthy. What happens when our immune system starts to attack itself? Well, the short answer is it is not pretty. We are going to learn more from author, motivational speaker, mother, and a card-carrying member of the Encephalitis Club, Jackie Stebbins from Bismarck. Jackie, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ashley. What a joy to be here.
So you are out with a new book called Unwillable, A Journey to Reclaim My Brain. This details your journey with the incredibly rare, incredibly difficult autoimmune encephalitis. So we should start there. And there's no real short answer to what happens to your body, but give us the... I'll call them lowlights, I guess, because I don't want to say highlights. That sounds entirely too positive. But what happens to your body when you have autoimmune encephalitis?
Well, you mentioned a short answer, but I'm actually a recovered trial lawyer, so I tend to be wordy by nature. And my illness, autoimmune encephalitis, what I call AE, is... it's complicated. That's probably the best word you could use to describe it, that and devastating. So I am in remission from a condition called autoimmune encephalitis, which probably the easiest way to explain it is, for some unknown reason, even unknown to the Mayo Clinic and researchers around the world, my immune system ramped itself up and set off to attack. But unfortunately, it attacked my otherwise very healthy brain. So this led to, I believe, a fairly protracted process. It started in about the fall of 2017. The symptoms were mild enough. It was interrupted sleep. I was waking up at about 4 a.m. like someone was setting an alarm clock in my mind. It was the strangest thing, and then it became quite exhausting. And then I became a full-fledged insomniac. And from there, my symptoms intensified, insomnia, serious anxiety. And then I left work, and my life took the darkest, blackest turn, a turn I couldn't even imagine, because until I woke up from this illness, I actually didn't even know that it existed.
Well, you say words like darkest, blackest turn, and in May of 2018, you actually checked yourself into a psychiatric unit because it had gotten this bad. I want, if you could, to read a segment from your book, and again, it's called Unwillable, A Journey to Reclaim the Brain. We are visiting with the author, Jackie Stebbins. If you could read a section from the book, please.
Absolutely. And this section actually comes right at the end of the chapter where I've detailed my 48-hour voluntary commitment to the psychiatric ward in Bismarck at the Samford Hospital. In Requiem for a Tower, most of the four-minute song is a repetitive overture of wailing violins, clashing cymbals, and dark, rhythmic chanting. But at minute 140, it slows down. For about 10 seconds, the song is pure devastation and despair. It's as if the song is just going to quietly give up on itself. In the soundtrack of my existence, when I crawl into bed at the ward that first night, I'm at minute 140 in the song. I believe that was the darkest point of my life. My mind was nothing more than devastation and hopeless despair, and my mind and body were both giving up on me because they could not go on. I doubt I believed it could get worse, but it did. I just didn't know it because I went further into my dark and lonely place of sickness and despair. The last futile attempts I made to recognize my life and be a part of it vanished when I left the ward. My memory goes mostly blank from the night of my release from the ward until I have a few small memories on May 22nd when I met Stephanie McDonald.
So many words in that stand out to me. Devastation, despair, quietly give up on itself. And you felt like you would quietly give up on yourself. And at this point, you're in your mid-30s. You're happily married. You have a couple of children that you very much wanted. You are a successful trial lawyer. You're even a partner in your own law firm. You're hitting all of your financial goals.
Yeah, life was amazing, right? Yeah. I had the world by the tail. I was 34 years old. My own law firm. It was called Stebbins Malloy. I was so intent that I could plan my future and control my destiny that I would often say to my husband, I really don't see anything changing for us. Mm-hmm. And boy, now, in hindsight, maybe I shouldn't have said that. But and all of a sudden, you know, again, it was fairly protracted. The interrupted sleep began in the fall of 2017. But by March of 2018, I was really unfolding. April, I was barely hanging on. And by May of 2018, I was in a free fall. So I went from this, you know, young, healthy, vibrant, successful senior partner at a law firm that bore my name to the point that I thought I was having a complete mental breakdown, that it was my fault, that I had worked myself to depression and anxiety that was manifesting itself in insomnia and tremors in my hands and a clenched jaw and white noise in my ears. I had this self-blame. I've done this to myself. And then what I honestly believe was probably the lowest point in my life where I felt like I needed the psych ward more than I'd ever needed anything in my life. And I had never, ever struggled with mental health, had never seen a counselor. Probably had some anxiety, but was probably a little too stubborn to admit it, but nothing, you know, of that measure. And all of a sudden I'm begging to be committed to a psychiatric ward. I'm hallucinating. I'm paranoid. I'm uncommunicative. I'm staring. I'm still an insomniac. I become kind of this pallid, ghostly looking woman who's wandering around my house, terrifying my husband. And just to be honest, Ashley, if you would have asked me, you know, maybe a year before this all unfolded, like, Jackie, where are the two last places on earth you'd ever find yourself? Mm. I probably would have said jail and the psychiatric ward. And all of a sudden, as I just read in that passage, I'm crawling into bed in this teeny little bed with a teeny thin sheet and a pillow, sobbing, saying, what the heck just happened to my life?
Yeah, as I was reading that part of the book and you talk about the tests that the medical professionals are giving you and, you know, they're writing simple letters or numbers or drawing a shape on the hand and you can't identify what those are. Somebody puts a key in your hand and you think that it's a butterfly. And this one test, the importance, Jackie, if you could elaborate on the cognitive function of why they have you draw a clock and then describe what it looked like when you tried to draw a clock.
So that was the first day that I saw Dr. Rolf Dunnigan, my neurologist, who was absolutely a lifesaver. And the woman that got him to me was Stephanie. I saw her at a follow-up appointment from the behavioral clinic about a week after I'd left the psychiatric ward. She took one look at me and said, this is a neurological problem, and got me where I needed to go, which honestly, it saved my life. So the first day with Dr. Dunnigan, per my husband and my mom's perspective, he could tell instantly, you know, that I was absolutely out of it with very limited cognitive capacity. And what else you have to understand about this story is I have amnesia through all of pretty much May and into June. So I remember bits and pieces, very fragmented, some of it distorted, some of it incorrect, some of it correct. So as I put this book together, you know, the climax of the book comes from this time where I have amnesia, right? But we pieced together all of it. And I actually have probably the most recollection of the month of May at that appointment with Dr. Dunnigan. Mm. And it's hard to explain, but I think there was part of me that knew I couldn't do it. But I couldn't go that step further and almost be sad about it or angry about it or really understand it. So as they were talking about something being wrong with my brain, it was kind of lost on me, right? And on May 3rd, I had been in court. I didn't feel well, but I was in court and I prevailed that day. This is now, you know, May 23rd, and I don't know my left from my right. So Dr. Dunnigan excuses my mom and my husband who were with me that day, and his nurses give me this called the MoCA test, Montreal Cognitive Assessment, a test that you would give someone if you think they maybe have dementia or a problem like mine. So I remember drawing the cube, which I could sort of do, and the first exercise was like, if this is the letter A and then the arrow goes to number 1 and then the arrow goes to the letter B, what would be the next step? Easy, too. I sat and bawled and said, I don't know what you're asking me to do.
Wow.
And so I always knew that I couldn't do that test, but I couldn't explain to my husband and my mom like what they were asking. I just knew that I sat and sobbed. And so we got to the point of where I drew the clock. And I guess all I can remember, you can see if you have the book Unwillable, the clock, the exact clock is on the cover. And you can see it's a bit shaky, as was my cube. But I pretty much piled the letters 1 through 8 on the right side of the clock. And the only thing I can really remember is it's like I knew I couldn't finish. And I just kind of put the number 9 about where the number 8 should be. And I just stopped and gave it back to her. And as I finished the exam, my mom and my husband came in. And I do remember Dr. Dunnigan looking at them, handing them the sheet of paper. And he said, well, her clock's interesting.
Hmm.
That's one way to put it. And again, I just sat there. Like, I couldn't grasp that I could not draw a clock. I was supposed to draw a complete clock, and I think it was supposed to be like 10 past 11. So I can't tell you in, you know, scholarly terms why they do that, but I know from reading Susanna Cahalan's book Brain on Fire, which she put a lot more medical terminology and scientific terminology in than I chose to in my book. And as I understand it then, since I piled everything on the right side of the clock, probably the left side of my brain wasn't working. And it was very readily apparent that I had a neurological problem when I couldn't draw a clock.
Yeah. Well, you had 2 young children at this time, and I'm thinking probably your son or daughter could have drawn the clock even, you know, better than you can. I mean, it looked like the kind of clock that someone who is just learning their numbers would draw, maybe a little smaller, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. That maybe a preschooler could have done a little better.
Yeah.
I mean, just talk about what a real staggering impact that this disease was having on me and what it was doing to my brain. When again, you know, 20 days prior, I fended off a motion for contempt in district court in Bismarck, North Dakota. And so the gravity of what was happening to me and how quickly it was progressing absolutely leads me to believe that if Stephanie McDonald had not intervened when she did and recognized the neurological problem, I firmly believe I would have suffered permanent brain damage, or I would not be having this conversation with you, Ashley, because I'd be dead.
What is the mortality rate for people with autoimmune encephalitis?
Per the AE Alliance, the U.S.-based group that I do a lot of work with, I believe it's 6%. So, you know, that seems like a nominal number, but, you know, gosh, that means that people can die from this illness, so it can be deadly.
We're visiting today with Jackie Stebbins about her book, Unwillable, A Journey to Reclaim My Brain. You can find out more at jmstebbins.com. And Jackie, in this book about your journey with your immune system fighting itself, inflaming your brain, causing this severe insomnia, this depression, this anxiety, hallucinations, you end up with osteoporosis, with cracked teeth because your jaw is tense all the time. You end up with cataracts. Your hair starts to fall out. You have to go on major doses of steroids. But I want to focus right now on the part that you already mentioned, this amnesia that you had. And as you're going and trying to write this book now, a couple of years later, and fortunately in remission, how did you start to put this all together? Talk about the journal that you kept and the times that it maybe was a little difficult to figure out what you had even been trying to write.
Absolutely. Oh my goodness. Writing a book is really a process. And I like to make the joke, but it's really not a joke, that lawyers kind of think they know everything. And you know what? Lawyers don't know everything, especially how to write a book. And I'd never before in my life thought of writing a book, right? I thought I was super boring and that I had like one talent, and I would point to my desk and say, this is my talent, my, you know, my lawyer desk. So writing a book, it never crossed my mind, but I wish I could tell you exactly when, Ashley, I said, dag nabbit, I'm going to write this book too. I don't know if there was a time or a certain time. Of course, my family doesn't remember. We were still kind of all in survival mode. But I only know that when I woke up and started to learn about my disease, my brain was turned back on with steroids. I woke up and learned that there was a New York Times bestselling book called Brain on Fire. And this woman had my illness, or I had her illness. And I decided right then and there, I am not going to read her book because I am already living this pure hell, to be quite honest. And I'm going to write my own book because even though I was so sick, I'm still so stubborn and driven. Some habits apparently die hard. So the first year, Ashley, to be very honest, I struggled for my life, and probably not a day went by that I didn't think I was just going to drop dead. What's going to get me? Epilepsy, the blood clots that were found floating around in my body, all this medication, the fact that my brain had been under attack. I thought I would die. So for 1 year, I had one goal, just live through this year. And then, you know, I there was something inside of me that said, if you can live for a year, you can do this. So that's kind of where my mantra, just keep swimming, came from. So I just kept swimming for the first year, and the book was all I thought about. It was probably past my children and my husband. It was the only thing that kept me going. And I thought about it and thought about it. And after I made that 1 year anniversary, the next day I started writing my book. So it was all kind of swirling around, and it was a lot of trial and error. I think the best thing I ever did was just sit down and write my heart out for the first year. And the worst thing I ever did was just sit down and write my heart out for a year because I was overwriting, until my good friend Clay Jenkinson kind of intervened, and we started talking about how many words I was writing. And I had already written like a 3-volume treatise just on, you know, my formative years in Bowman, North Dakota.
Well, Clay will do that too.
Right? So that first year that I wrote, I put everything down on paper. And so that was 2019, 2020. And in the meantime, I had found out, you know, I was miraculously pregnant, something I wasn't expecting. I had this post-AE baby. So I have this high-risk pregnancy. I'm coming off of this debilitating, devastating, earth-shattering disease, and I'm trying to write this book.
You know, the usual.
Just the usual. You know, it was a Monday. It was a Tuesday. So for that, the first year of survival, I thought about the journals that I had kept in the psych ward, but I never touched them. Yeah. So after kind of that 1 year anniversary, I opened up the journals expecting to just find, like, you know, worms crawling out of it. But it was a little better than I thought. You know, my writing was sometimes struggled and shaky, but that brought back a few memories. So that really helped. And I kept a journal starting when my brain was turned back on. So that was wonderful. But I really think that journal I kept in the psych ward and around the time that the disease was unfolding. And you can tell me if you felt this way, Ashley, but reading my book, reading those journal entries, it really is insight into someone losing their mind.
Yeah.
So the journals, I thought, were absolutely so powerful, just a real firsthand account that, of course, I never could have remembered if I wouldn't have been trying so desperately to write, which, of course, at some point I couldn't do anymore. Ironically, I asked my mom to write in my journal for me after I was released from the psych ward, because I was just so determined that I could get myself better. The second year, I continued to write and edit, and that's where really the doubt set in. I thought, I can't write a book. Who am I? You know, I am recovering from this brain injury. I was still struggling with grief and loss and trauma, and it was COVID, and we lived like hermits because of my wonky immune system, and we're homeschooling. But I just kept trying, and then really the breakthrough, I think, came in early 2021, my good friends Jack Weinstein and Kim Donenhauer said, Jackie, hey, maybe you should take a writing class. Oh, my goodness. So I took some writing classes at the Loft. What a novel idea. And my friend Wolfgang, who has written a few novels, he's a really prolific writer, he said, Jackie, you need to stop and just start reading every memoir you can. And I took that advice, and it was great. So I started taking the writing classes, read so many memoirs as I was doing kitchen table school. And then in the summer of 2021, I just rewrote the book and said, okay, I think I got it now.
And what made you want to include so many song lyrics? This is evident both on your blog at jmstebbins.com and then throughout the book, you reference Elton John quite a bit. And even the section we had you read near the beginning of this conversation, a song from the soundtrack of Requiem for a Dream. The song was Requiem for a Tower. You also have Let It Be in there and The Boxer. What is it about those songs?
So two parts. The first is that I'm a shamelessly obsessed Elton John fan. This is the part in the conversation where my husband and all my close friends like roll their eyes and leave because they know I'm going to talk about my love for Elton. But I have such a love for Elton John, and I love his music. And my office, my home office, is kind of a shrine to Elton. I have a great picture. He and I fist bumped at a concert in Bismarck, North Dakota.
Oh, man.
Yeah, in 2011. So I think he's a great person, and, you know, you can like him, dislike him, but he really is just him. And that's something I respect so much. And what a timeless classic. I mean, he's still going strong. I just saw him in Fargo this March, which was wonderful. So I love Elton John. I needed to find a way to work him and his lyrics into the book, or I would have disappointed my friends who find me to be so predictable. But, oh gosh, the music, Ashley, it was my therapy, I think, for a long time. I wasn't ready for counseling when I was really in the throes of recovery, and my music was my therapy. But, you know, backing up why it's included in the book, a lot of those songs, I say, started to play out like an eerie soundtrack of my existence. And the lyrics to The Boxer, you know, I am leaving, but the fighter still remains. Oh, my gosh. You know, as I am literally almost kind of leaving Earth, I'm almost kind of having this out-of-body experience where I'm this shaky, trembling, weepy, confused woman, you know, kind of like, who is she? And I would sing Let It Be, you know, and there will be no sadness. Let it be. All of this is happening as I have no idea what's attacking me and overtaking me. And then there was that powerful song, Hall of Fame, that I would watch with my oldest daughter. And it was just kind of this fun girl power song. And all of a sudden in my recovery, it was a willpower song for me to live, to, you know, to be around for my kids.
We're visiting today with author Jackie Stebbins about her book, Unwillable, A Journey to Reclaim My Brain. This details the story of her battle with the incredibly rare, incredibly difficult disease, autoimmune encephalitis, where the body's immune system attacks itself, and in this case, started to go after her brain. We are going to be back with more of this conversation after this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. With demand at an all-time high, North Dakota's only food bank projects that it may fall roughly 800,000 meals short of last year's total. Kate Mulbert is chief operating officer at the Great Plains Food Bank. She says the COVID-19 pandemic, followed by record high inflation, is translating to challenges in keeping shelves at the food bank stocked for their clients. She says while the pandemic created leaner supply chains, food prices are 14.3% higher than they were a year ago. She says the food bank may see a 1 million pound distribution shortfall, while one in six North Dakotans are impacted by hunger.
We partner in some mobile distributions locally, and the number of people attending those local distributions have gone up, I think, 60% the last few months as compared to last fall and winter. So we've seen pretty significant uptick in the amount of need in our communities.
Mulbert says donations to the food bank are at their lowest level since 2018, when the organization was serving 30,000 fewer people than it is today. Despite the challenges ahead, Mulbert says they are doing everything they can to serve those in the community who are hungry. The food bank is budgeting $2.2 million to purchase food, which is the largest amount in its 39-year history. She says no one who needs help should be discouraged from receiving it at the food bank. They are forecasting to be able to provide 10 million meals over the next year. Mulbert says financial donations can be made on the Great Plains Food Bank's website. Over the weekend, North Dakota joined in the national launch of a new behavioral health hotline, 988.
You can call 988 for any behavioral health crisis, and that really means any, you know, if you or someone you love is struggling with suicide ideation or mental health or substance use, you can call 988 and speak with a trained crisis counselor. that crisis counselor will provide support, engagement, you know, potentially connect you with other resources if that's deemed necessary.
Laura Anderson is the assistant director of the State Health Department's Behavioral Health Division. She says North Dakota is in a good place when it comes to implementing the new 988 system. She says FirstLink already operates the state's 211 helpline. Anderson says FirstLink will continue operating the 211 lifeline and will also take calls from those dialing 988.
At this point, anyone who calls 211 for crisis, or even if they still call the 1-800 Suicide Prevention Lifeline number, they will still go to the same place. So there's no wrong door. There's no wrong number. It's just a transition to start, you know, using 988 instead.
Anderson says in 2020, the 211 center received just over 6,000 crisis calls. It has increased since then, with the center receiving over 8,500 calls in 2021. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
People living across the U.S. are paying more for gas and groceries. But one economist says Americans living outside the big cities are feeling a sharper bite from inflation.
They're dipping into savings now, but if these prices continue, then they're going to start going into debt.
So some Americans are wondering, should they stay or should they move? How rural America gets by in a bad economy, on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
There's 5 hours of Morning Edition every weekday here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now from our Bismarck studio is author and motivational speaker Jackie Stebbins. She is joining me to talk about her book, Unwillable, A Journey to Reclaim My Brain, about her battle with autoimmune encephalitis. And Jackie, just before the news, we were talking about the importance of songs in your therapy and in just feeling as close to sane as is possible with a body that's attacking itself. And the lyrics to the boxer, I am leaving, but the fighter still remains. And you said it felt like you were kind of floating from this earth, but there is that will to live that stayed very strong in you. We've talked this whole time about your disease. Let's talk about who is Jackie, you know, before and after autoimmune encephalitis.
Oh, gosh, Ashley, that's such a loaded question. I hope you're putting your therapist hat on right now, because, you know, that's taken me years to be able to answer and to not just sob, you know, and I'm not being facetious when I say that even maybe a year ago, for sure, actually, a year ago, if you'd have asked me that, I probably would have just started crying and said, I don't know who I am, Ashley. Who am I? You know, what am I doing? What is this? And it's just, it has been an uphill battle. I can tell you that. And here I sit today. I look like myself. I sound like myself. My hair is growing. It's growing so long, honestly, just because I can. I probably should trim it up, but you know, I can wear my old clothes. I can drive. All these things that probably day to day, so many people just take for granted, like your hair grows and it's not falling out and you're not trying to find a hairpiece, or you can drive yourself to your own appointments, that you can confidently say, you know what? I was a lawyer and it was great, but I'm not anymore, and that's okay. That took until, about yesterday to be able to confidently say that and say, you know what? Jackie was more than being a lawyer. But yeah, I mean, my entire identity was wrapped up and I had worked very hard. I mean, you know, you go to law school and you work so hard. And even before that, this dream for me started in fifth grade when I read John Grisham's book, The Client, and I was hooked. And from high school on, you know, every grade I got, activity I joined, the way I, you know, plan my very meager finances was to be able to be Jackie M. Stebbins, attorney at law. And I was. And, you know, judges respected me. They trusted me. They knew my work product, you know, and that was something I had earned. And it's kind of the school of hard knocks to be a trial lawyer. You have to take some punches and get back up and sometimes, honestly, get kicked into the dirt and get right back up. And I had been doing that, you know, for 9 years. And to have that rug ripped out from under me, I left work on a Tuesday and told my staff, I'll be back in a week. I finally admitted I'm struggling with depression. I have anxiety. I haven't slept. I'll be back in a week. Mm-hmm. And I left my office that day to never, ever return. So there was no retirement party. There was no plan. This was not a conscious decision. You know, it was almost like I was just shoved off a cliff on a Tuesday in 2018. And I had to get up and dust myself off and say, okay, what's next? But I wish it was that easy. I mean, I had to lie in the dirt, I think, for a while and say, what if this is as good as it's going to get? This woman that was 40 pounds overweight from the steroids made me gain tons of fluid weight. My face was so swollen it looked like it was going to pop.
And you had a nice mustache.
I had a mustache. And let me tell you, there's a few things that, you know, I really didn't want to have in life. And like a mustache and sideburns. Shaving my face. And I walked hunched over. I looked like a humpback because the steroids also do that. My skin, you know, had stretched so much it burst. I have a spot in my armpit that looks like a skin graft. It looks like I've been burned. So, I mean, there's very visible scars, you know, on my body of what this did to me. There's scars on my brain that no one can see. And so to just think that you're going to wake up and say, oh, goodness, that was tough. Well, I'll just run right back to life as usual. No. So recovery, you know, in some ways, sitting here, hindsight changes it. When I was first writing the book, you know, it was what happened to me was the worst. But as I look back now, it was recovery, feeling lost, feeling unknown. People didn't recognize me. People I knew, you know, introduced themselves to me. Usually I'm very gregarious. I'm outgoing. I'm chatty. I think I'm far funnier than I am. I was alone. I was isolated. I couldn't speak in public. And even to this day, people comment on my brain and how it works. And it's just that I'm confident enough now to just kind of roll with it. And usually I know when people have really good intentions and they mean well. But it's really hard to feel like people are analyzing you in your mind when, you know, you once had this sharp, laser-focused legal mind and all of a sudden, you know, they knew that you didn't know left from right and that you struggled to carry a conversation and that you had anxiety so bad it made you shake. You know, people were watching me and it was just a really terrible feeling. So recovery was the hardest thing I've ever done, but thank goodness I am so stubborn and I do have such a drive. And I think it's on the back of the book in the elevator pitch. You know, my drive could be a burden to me. And in hindsight, you know, sometimes it was, but what a blessing. Otherwise, I don't think, again, we'd be having this conversation today.
That drive, you spend a lot of the book blaming yourself for this illness, that you pushed yourself too hard, that you wore yourself out, even though, you know, every doctor told you repeatedly that's not what happened here. Do you still blame yourself?
No. The good news is I finally was able to absolve myself. And I really think there's a pivotal point in the book when I'm at the Mayo Clinic, and not to, you know, give spoilers, but, you know, where Dr. Zakiradu absolved me of guilt. And I needed to hear it because the problem was this darn illness is so sneaky. You know, it really is a chameleon and it blends in. It presents itself in a psychiatric. And for me, I will very much admit, you know, I probably did stigmatize mental health, even though I would pride myself as a trial lawyer. I dealt with a lot of people who had mental illness, addiction. I understood it, but it was like, well, that's them. That's not me. Right. So I had this stigma. So to all of a sudden find myself in the psychiatric ward and to have this inordinate amount of self-blame, like, Jackie, you've done this. Because when I presented with the insomnia, when I finally let my guard down, people around me were like, Jackie, you're a workaholic. Like, you've burnt yourself out. Of course you are depressed. Of course you have anxiety. That was then reaffirmed in the psychiatric ward, which I don't blame anyone. You know, I absolutely do not blame anyone. This illness is very challenging. But that self-blame was kind of reaffirmed when I was misdiagnosed with anxiety, depression, and a panic disorder. And then finally I wake up and there's this moment in the book where my husband and mom are saying, Jackie, no, like you never belonged in the psychiatric ward. You have, it's your brain, autoimmune encephalitis. And I say, oh, then it kind of clicked. Oh my goodness, I have this brain illness. And then, you know, I went to Mayo and yeah, Dr. Z said, you did nothing wrong. Like you didn't, you know, if all trial lawyers could be as stressed out enough to get autoimmune encephalitis, I promise it wouldn't be like a one in a million. And I wouldn't be the only – well, I shouldn't say. There's a lawyer in Alaska I've met and a lawyer in Minnesota, two men that I met during recovery that had AE. But it would be more common if stress caused it, and doctors would have it and other people in high-stress jobs. So I think for me the book, though, was a reckoning of being a young, driven female in essentially a male-dominated profession – and, you know, someone who grew up in very, you know, limited means on this wonderful, you know, farm and ranch in rural North Dakota with a great family, but money was not a luxury for me growing up, and how hard I worked through school. I think I kind of had to reckon, though, how hard I was pushing myself to get to my dreams, and was it healthy? And, you know, at the end of the day, that's past my pay grade, and I'm proud of myself. I'm proud of what I've done. I'm proud of how I've handled my life. But do I take a little more measured approach now, maybe, to life and to goals and dreams? Yeah, I do.
Yeah, and you did on that fateful Tuesday walk away from being a lawyer, walking away from being a partner at your own law firm, Stebbins Malloy. You call yourself a fully recovered lawyer, but you do still have your license.
I do.
Maybe you'll go back?
So the elevator pitch now that I can say and not cry is it was a good run. I love what I did. I'm proud of what I did. I'm so proud of Stebbins Malloy. You know, my old partner, Michael Malloy, still practices. We have a great relationship. We're great friends. I wish him the best. It was, you know, we both kind of know it was a breakup we didn't want, and it was just what life handed to us, and it was terrible. It was hard. It was traumatic. It was sad. But I love what we did. I love what I did. And as I say in the book, you know, all good things must come to an end, right? Or so they say. So I don't think that's going to happen again, and I'm okay with it. But, you know, I offer the caveat of the devil himself will pry that license out of my cold, dead hands. I worked for that. That is mine. And I just made the decision that no one, absolutely no one, gets to take that away from me.
Jackie, the book is called Unwillable, and now here we are 35 minutes into the conversation. I'm finally going to ask you why you called it that, because you talk about how, you know, no one could cause this sort of thing, even though you spent a lot of time blaming yourself. But there is a funny section in the book where you ask your mom years ago when you were a kid what it takes to be a motivational speaker, and, you know, you are well-spoken, you're confident, but, you know, you didn't have that backstory. Did you will this into existence?
I like where you're going with this, Ashley. So I would love to say that, you know, I had that title from day one. Actually, we landed at the title, and I say we, because my title stunk. Numerous people in my life, including my mom. I mean, she was
pretty. What was it?
So the first one was The Lawyer Who Wasn't Depressed, and I loved that title. And my friend Clay, like others, were like, that's the worst title ever. So then
I would watch that Netflix series. Just going to put that out there.
I thought it was wonderful. So then my next one was, you know, The Lawyer Who Wasn't Crazy. And I, because there's a point in my book where, you know, honestly, it's the saddest, most profound thing I said in that whole book, probably in the whole time I was ill and recovering, when I looked at a provider in the behavioral ward and said, I feel like I'm going crazy. You know, this shaky, jittery, fragile woman that, you know, this is where I'm at. I don't even know how to explain it, except I feel like I'm going crazy. So I changed it to The Lawyer Who Wasn't Crazy. My writing class was all like, that's awful. So then I moved to Requiem for Me, kind of with that Requiem for a Tower. Oh, I love that title. That's where my mom was like, yeah, no. So I just sat on it. Clay was also very adamant, no. So I sat on it until I landed my publisher. And very early on, one of the two owners was like, oh, and we'll change your title. I was like, yeah, I thought that was coming. So Stevie, the director of development, and I sat down and just kind of had this brainstorming session. And we liked will, you know, the pun on lawyers, and my strong, stubborn will, but the will to survive. And that's where we came to Unwillable. And I love it.
Yeah, when I first heard I was going to be interviewing a lawyer about a book called Unwillable, I thought this was going to be a book about, you know, writing your own will.
Ooh, and sadly enough, that might be kind of boring. So Maybe I should have changed my subtitle. Warning, this isn't a lawyer book. I mean, it sort of is, but not really.
Right. This is a not depressed, not crazy lawyer. This is not a book about writing wills. It's a catchy title.
Thank you. Thank you. Yes. From what I hear, it was much better than all of my attempts put together.
The book, again, is called Unwillable, A Journey to Reclaim My Brain. Author Jackie Stebbins. You can find out more at jmstebbins.com. A couple of book signings coming up August 22nd at Ferguson Books in West Fargo. There will be a speech along with Clay Jenkinson. You've mentioned him a couple times on September 8th and book signing there in Bismarck and on September 22nd in your hometown of Bowman, North Dakota. Jackie, thank you so much for your time today.
What a joy to be here, Ashley. Thank you so much for having me.
Capital Shakespeare is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Otto Bremer Trust, investing in people, places, and opportunities in North Dakota, Montana, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. Learn more at ottobremer.org.
KALW's The Spiritual Edge has a new documentary. It's called Becoming Muslim.
Islam was probably the last religion I would have ever seen myself as converting to.
Listen as we explore the challenges of people from diverse cultures who choose Islam.
Becoming Muslim, this week's Prairie Public Presents, coming your way Sunday afternoon at 5 Central, 4 Mountain.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Alicia Heglin Thorpe. A free production of William Shakespeare's The Merry Wives of Windsor will be performed later this month in Bismarck at the outdoor Prairie Amphitheater on the North Dakota State Capitol grounds. And the audience is in for quite a performance on this play. And here to tell us why is the director of the play and also the director of Capital Shakespeare. Her name is Erin Weichel. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us more about Capital Shakespeare.
Well, we've been around for 15 years, which some people don't know. We started pretty small, and over the years we've grown. We do two productions in the summer. One is a youth theater production called The Young Bards, and then our main stage Shakespearean production. And then in the winter, we do a classic play inside, because it's in February, at the North Dakota Heritage Center Russell Reed Auditorium.
Okay. So this summer, then, we have Young Bards performing. And that's prior to the performance of Merry Wives, correct?
Correct.
Tell us more about what that is and what they're performing.
So Young Bards is a youth theater program for students ages 12 to 17. And we offer that through some donations and grants free to those students as well. And so what they do is they start practicing in June, and they are doing a 15-minute performance of Twelfth Night, which was the very first play Capital Shakespeare ever put on. So we thought for the 15th year, 15 minutes of the first play.
Now, what's significant about the Twelfth Night, though? I see that around in different places, like when people are just starting their acting career. There's just something about that play.
It's probably one of Shakespeare's most recognizable plays, and it has some really phenomenal roles for women in it as well as men. It's where you get the line, some men are born great and some have greatness thrust upon them. And it's just got some really great characters that every actor is like, I want that on my resume.
Okay, understood. And now The Merry Wives of Windsor, this Shakespearean play. Now, this was the 1600s when he wrote this, but I'm understanding that this set is like more of the 1950s. How did that come around?
We were thinking about a time when the story is all about women, right? And women being funny and kind of going against the normal role. And we started to think about women in the history who have done that, and Lucille Ball kept popping up in our brain of a funny woman who kind of went against what was normal at her time period, because women weren't supposed to be funny. Mm-hmm. And so we thought that was great, and we ran with it. The play also has so much physical humor and comedy, and that's also very much her style. So it allowed us to play a little bit with that idea of here's what a normal woman should be, but here's what these funny Windsor wives are.
So has it been performed like this before?
We've done shows out of the 1600 time period before, and a lot of Shakespearean theater companies do that because it allows the audience to relax a little bit. There's not so much that's different, right? They're listening to the V's and the thous and the pentameter, and it's just overwhelming, as well as looking at these costumes that they don't understand. So if you move it forward to something more recognizable, the brain relaxes and they can get into the language a little easier.
That sounds fascinating. So what can the audience look forward to when watching this play, or actually these two plays then?
They're really easy to understand. These two comedies, and Merry Wives is almost a farce, the way that it's written. There's hiding people in closets and dressing people up as a woman and all this different stuff. So they're really easy to follow and understand. And then the nice thing is we do put a synopsis of the play in our program. So if you come and you're like, I have no idea what to look forward to, you follow paragraph by paragraph and it goes scene by scene and you can keep up with exactly what's going on.
So for people who may think, I don't get Shakespeare, you're actually able to help them physically understand what's going on.
Yes. And Shakespeare's wrote plays. They're meant to be seen, not read in an English classroom sitting at a desk. So when you see them, it makes so much more sense because the characters are moving, they're using their whole bodies and their vocal inflection for you to understand what it is that they're saying.
So when and where is it performed and who can attend?
Performances are July 20th through the 24th at the North Dakota Heritage Center Prairie Amphitheater, which is right next to their new beautiful glass Northern Lights atrium. And performances start at 7 with the Young Bards, and then Merry Wives will start directly right after that. Anyone is welcome. Everyone is welcome. We are free to the public, but we do take free will donations to allow us to keep that mission going. I would say that anybody who wants to try and come and see this show should come and see this show. My 7-year-old daughters are super excited to come and see it. So I think it'll be a great night of entertainment. Just make sure to bring a blanket or a chair to sit on. We will have some concessions available, but they're kind of limited. It's just our Shakespeare cookies, which are really good. And then we have some mocktails that we sell and some flavored iced teas that we'll sell.
Okay. And best of all, it's free.
Yes.
Yeah, except for the mocktails.
Yes. Yes.
Except
but
for
they're,
the mocktails.
They're pretty reasonable. So
that's pretty cool. Tell us more about your cast members. Who's in this play?
We have some really awesome people who have been in a number of our plays throughout the years that are back. So you'll see some recognizable faces if you've come before. But we actually have a lot of really brand new people to the cast, which is exciting. People who've just moved to Bismarck or who finally were like, you know what? I decided this was the play. I was going to finally audition. And it's a phenomenal cast. It's so funny. There's nights I leave and my stomach hurts from laughing so hard at rehearsals. And I've seen this show, I don't even know how many times at this point, but the cast is phenomenal. Our youngest member is about 18, and I think our oldest is in their 50s. So it's a great range of actors.
Well, thank you so much, Erin, Capital Shakespeare director, for talking to us today about the Merry Wives of Windsor performance. Again, that's at the Prairie Amphitheater on the North Dakota State Capitol grounds, July 20th through the 24th. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
I'm Kelly Corrigan, and this week I'm wondering about the relationship between hope, youth, and progress, especially in regard to the climate. I have spent the past few months talking to teen activists about their commitment to reversing, or at least mitigating, the damage done by burning fossil fuels. Join me.
Kelly Corrigan Wonders, coming up tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Daybook for July 19th. North Dakota holds a number of remnants of once active radar and missile sites. They were established during the Cold War, and one of these sites was near Fortuna. The Fortuna Air Base was already active by 1951. In the summer of 1961, local interest in the site abounded as construction of a radar tower began. Citizens knew about its construction and could monitor the development through reports in local newspapers. And there was no hiding the project. It was a 5-story concrete tower. cost close to $1 million, with an additional $5 million appropriated to equip the structure. A ribbon cutting was scheduled as the tower neared completion, and on this date, a competition for naming the tower was advertised in local papers. The Name the Radar Building contest was sponsored by Crosby Business Builders and Fortuna Merchants, as well as the Fortuna Air Base. Anyone could submit a name. They just had to bring their suggestion to any store in Fortuna or to any member of the Crosby Business Builders by the first day of August. Three people would serve as judges: Air Base Commander Major Harold Daniel, Crosby Legion Commander L.A. Rutherford, and Crosby Mayor Orville Trihus. One stipulation was that the title had to, quote, be in line with the mission of the tower, unquote, which was to detect aircraft. The public was invited to the facility during an open house on August 4th. Around 100 people took advantage of the occasion. They got a guided tour of the facility. Among the attendees was Miss Northwest of 1961, Lloydine Poling of Crosby, a runner-up in the 1961 Miss North Dakota contest. She came to unveil a tower plaque. She was escorted by Captain Barty Miracle for a personal tour of the building. She also had another special role to play. She presented J.A. Jorenstad of Crosby with $75 for his winning entry in the radar naming competition. It's not a name that would probably win these days. The tower was dubbed the Sioux Sentinel. Refreshments followed. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Historical and Cultural Society of Clay County, bringing art and history to the MCOM Center in Moorhead, Minnesota. Details at hcsconline.org.
Hi, I'm Tom Brusso on the Next Great American Folk Show, a live session from Josh Rouse, whose laid-back summertime grooves were cooked up in his transplanted home in Spain. Plus, Juno Award-winning Canadian folk artists Ferris and Jason Romero.
I'm a souvenir of time well spent, well spent.
And speaking of Canada, Willie Watson covers folk legend the late Stan Rogers. And we've got cowboy poetry from Marcy Broyhill. The Great American Folk Show. Listen Saturday at 5 p.m. Central Time on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, shopping for produce and getting your knives sharpened at the same time. We visit with a knife sharpener who has a booth up at the Red River Farmers Market. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.